guys. So I'm here with Adina Sumter Freitag, storyteller, poet, and playwright who grew up in the north end of Winnipeg, Manitoba. Adina's poetry has been published as a chapbook, Black, Brown, and Still Blue, and has been featured in such nonfiction as Women's Bodies, Women's Live, published by Sumac Press. Recently, Adina's one-woman play, Stay Black and Die, which was originally performed in 1995 with the Edison Electric Company Theatre in Vancouver, BC, was published in 2007 with Commodore Books, also from Vancouver, BC. Adina's new book of poetry, titled Back in the Days, is forthcoming in 2009 from Waddle and Daub Press. In Stay Black and Die, Adina gives her audience the multi-voiced story of a girl called Penny, growing up in 1950s and 1960s North Winnipeg. While the primary voice speaking to the audience is that of Penny at various stages and ages in her life, the voices of Penny's mother, her father, her siblings, her friends, and others also inhabit her character as she moves through the telling of story to story. The play also includes stage directions to much 50s and 60s pop, soul, and R&B, and the references to these songs provide a vibrant soundscape to the play. I met with Adina at University of British Columbia in December to discuss the play's multi-voices and its aural layers and the challenges of translating such a provocative performance from the stage to the page. So first of all, thanks for meeting with me today.
You're welcome. That's a good introduction.
Hopefully. it's really great to meet and talk with you after hearing your performance at the Shortline Reading Series in October and after having a chance to read the play. I'm really sad that I didn't get to see the original performance.
Yeah, me too.
Sounds like it was a one-time great opportunity.
Yeah.
So I'm really fascinated by this, and I noticed in the notes to the play you talked about how the script was an adaptation from letters you had recorded on tape to a friend of yours, Beverly. And so as a reader and a listener, I feel like this really comes through in the reading of the play and in your performance, the small bit that I did see. So yeah, as a reader and a listener, I feel like this work really captures that process from, I think, the recording and then sending them and then the transcription. And it's funny because we're recording this interview, which is also going to be transcribed.
Right. Exactly. We'll bring those words to life.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I guess so, yeah, after hearing you in October and keeping in mind that I wasn't in around for the original staging of the play, I just wonder at the way you were able to transform the voices on the page so that even in my reading of the play, it really came to life, even on the page. So yeah, and yet, you know, the layering of voices and the references to music, you know, I think especially work that way, mm-hmm. even though you can't hear them. So yeah, I think the book, Stay Black and Die, really does occupy a space between sound and the page. And I wondered if maybe to start you could talk a little bit about that process of transcribing the recordings and maybe also about adapting the transcriptions to the play script, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So like just the process of transcribing the recordings and then how that sort of morphed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, transcribing the recordings was actually a surprise to me.
Okay.
You know, because like I had said, the recordings were like letters to my friend Beverly. And she and I have been friends since we were young. And we have a way of playing. And a way that, you know, involves, I guess, you know, copying people, you know, and I'm a storyteller. That's, you know, I come from the best story, the greatest storyteller in the world, which is my mother. And for me, telling these stories were so natural that once I started, because to start was, you know, you were kind of stilted and you turned the tape on, because I was finding that writing, you know, it doesn't come out fast enough.
No.
So I thought, well, maybe I'll just make, you know, a tape, and then it was a cassette, mm-hmm. and talk to her. So at first I would talk, and it would be, hi, Beverly, da-da-da, because you don't know what to say to this
machine.
Tape machine. And then I would start, and something would click, and I'd get into a story and I would just go, and that would lead to another one, and I'd run back and click it on and just nice. Go. And so this was how it originally started.
Okay.
And I never thought until, you know, to write them, because to me they were just letters and they were gone as I posted
yeah.
them.
Yeah.
Until I years later saw Beverly and she pulled up this big box with letters and the tapes and everything.
Wow.
And I thought, oh my God. And then I was listening to them and I thought, oh, I gotta write this. This is just so funny.
Yeah.
And so then I started writing them. And in my head, at that point in my life, I wasn't a writer.
Okay.
I was a storyteller. And to me, they were quite different. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, the oral, it was very, you know, familiar to me.
Yeah.
The writing part was not.
Right, right.
And so then the stories themselves, they just fell onto the paper. And the voices came so naturally because, mm-hmm. you know, like my mother, I mimic, you know, everything else to entertain. She's the greatest entertainer she was. And that's how the voices came through.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. That's really, I know what you mean when you sort of have this mediation like we have here recording our voices. It's a bit strange. It's not like conversation that you're going to have, you know, sort of in passing when you know that mediation is there,
mm-hmm.
right? Recording your voice. That's really interesting. I guess then my next question would be, how does, as somebody who is familiar with storytelling but not with writing, how does your conception of a listener or audience or reader maybe differ between the three of them, or do they, like, was that something that you thought about as you were preparing the script?
That's a really hard question. Let me see. I'm just going to answer what
I think
and tell me if I answered you. When I was preparing the script, all I did was at first transcribe everything from the tape.
Okay.
And then I'm picturing this process. This is when I first went to university, how I wrote as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So then everything was typed out, and there were just maybe 100, you know, sheets of paper, and I lined them up, and then I would go up and in between them and look at them, and I go, oh, you know, Delenco's store, oh, the landlord.
Oh,
and then I would call the pieces, you know, something. And then I would look at them all and, you know, write them down, and then I'd say, you know, where does it begin, you know? And the thing for me was waking up every day and starting in the house with her.
Mm.
And so this is where I started, waking mm-hmm. up in the mornings. And then it would flow, and then an idea would come and that would remind me of this and that. And I numbered them, and then it just started going until then. And that's how I used to write everything, was to record it, then write. And then I started, people would go, oh, Adina, blah, 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 she's a writer. And I thought, oh, they're calling me a writer. They're saying I'm a writer. And then I thought, damn, I'm a writer.
You're a writer, yeah, yeah.
And I realized I've always been a writer. You know, I've been writing since I was 12. You know, I've got poems and stuff. And actually, I'm writing some of those now.
Yeah.
Except until someone else said I was a writer, you know, in my mind, I wasn't.
Wow. So it was a turning point or a shift, a transformation.
Yeah. And now, I mean, but see, it's funny because I still write, but when I write, it's first on a page.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With a pen or a pencil or, you know, a lipstick or
whatever you happen to have.
On an air sickness bag, you know. And then I take it and, you know, go to the computer with it.
Okay.
When I sit at the computer I can edit that way once I've started.
Yeah.
But I still print things off and edit that way instead of on the computer. It's just something that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
My soul's not connected
embodied.
To that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
To that screen yet.
Oh, I feel that too, for sure. Especially when you're going through ideas. I think that's like you can't, I know for me, yeah, the computer is right. not where my ideas kind of really form. It's in talking and writing things down.
And see, this is why I think people go, oh, I loved your book, or I love your poetry. It's just blah, blah, blah. You know, the voices are, and it's because they come from a voice.
Yeah.
See, I think most people, well, I shouldn't say what I think most people. Mm-hmm. I think most people, yeah, I'll say it, what the hell. I think most people, when they read something, you know, they've already have a, you know, a certain, they've conceived something in their mind of what it should be,
mm-hmm.
you know. When they, I'm thinking, when they read my work, you know, poems or stories, the voices come out at them.
Yeah.
You know, and people go, oh my God, I just, you know, that much. And it's, I don't know, it somehow, it jumps out more because they come from a voice speaking to them.
Right.
You know, so the storyteller's in front of them. It's not, they're taking these words off the paper.
No, no. You know? It originated with that voice.
Yeah, and I really think that makes a different connection.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Oh, it certainly came through for me in reading. I guess, yeah, that's really interesting place to go. I was thinking kind of related to that, actually. I'm really interested in writers like, we've talked about Wade Compton,
mm-hmm.
who's included aural material, like a CD.
Right.
And he cites a bunch of Black Soul, Blues, Rap, and R&B artists. And he has that Reinventing Wheel, which is a, you know, performance of itself. And mm-hmm. Gregory Schofield, I may have mentioned him when we were chatting the other day, whose work in I Knew Two Métis Women also uses kind of, or has multi-layered voices and includes the lyrics of old country music, actually, in his book. Yeah, it's really great. I should loan it to you. And so, yeah, so I'm wondering, your book also seems to have that connection, and that I think these two books also have. And so I'm wondering if maybe you could talk about the soundtrack of the play and how you came to kind of conceive of the page, how the page would represent the music that you cite, that was in the play, like especially with the stage directions that's fading in and out and,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. It's because music is such a part of our life,
mm-hmm.
And food. You know, people remember. They might forget, you know, so many details, but they remember the song that was playing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they remember, you know, the first time I ever tasted dalmades, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so those kind of things, like even when you're going,
mm-hmm.
those things give you that feeling.
Yeah.
And it's, okay, you walk into, you know, a dance, you know, what we call a canteen dance in Winnipeg.
Yeah.
And your first slow dance, you know, and say it was stay, you could just feel the music starting inside you, and you remember, oh my God, Stay was playing, and you stay just a little, and you can feel how you swayed, and it just brings everything alive, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, your ears are tingling from the inside out.
Your
it's just,
little.
Yeah, and it shoots you right back there.
Yeah.
So the music, you know, even if someone doesn't know that song, if they thought, well, what the hell was that song?
Mm-hmm.
And they went, you know, now they can go online, and they went online and played it. They go, oh, you know, I mean, it would even come more alive.
Yeah.
People
yeah.
who were from that era or who have heard of that song or, you know, old song collectors or something
yeah.
would, you know, immediately know what it was and identify. But the music, it was so important.
Yeah. In terms of marking
moments and marking. Yeah. Time and eras and things like that. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So really the soundtrack was determined by the events,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to like you picking certain songs that sort of seemed to fit with it. It was really, really embodied like that with memory.
Right, right. Yeah. And I mean, see, I wasn't there for some of the, you know,
right.
stories.
Yeah,
some of
yeah.
the stories come from my brother.
Mm.
You know, they're coming through me, but they're actually my brother's memory. Some of them are my mother's memory, you know. Coming through me again, and it seems as if I were alive forever. Lots of them aren't my stories.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So the music, when my brother, for instance, in the book, goes to the church. Well,
yeah.
you know, you it would be gospel music,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't know what sound, you know, okay. that he would have heard or what music. I knew it would have been gospel, and I sort of know where the, you know, the beat yeah. would be. And I have a friend here who's a wonderful jazz singer, Lovey Eli,
mm-hmm.
and I asked her if she would, you know, record a song that I could use in the play.
Oh, neat.
And she recorded Soon As I Can See Jesus.
Oh,
and the beat, I mean, it just, it fit for me. It goes, you know, Soon As I Can See Jesus.
Right.
Yeah, you know,
right,
like
right.
this. And it was there. And you know, it might not have been the song that was playing, you know, when Leslie went into the church.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the song that gave life to the whole, you know, scene of him going to the church for the first time and seeing black people, you know,
yeah.
so many black people, and, you know.
Such a
yeah.
such a crystal kind of moment
yeah.
for him, crystallization.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah, music really does function that way, I
oh,
think.
Oh, for sure.
And I think that's such a huge part of why this text is able to come alive on the page. I mean, a lot of the songs are familiar, and so, you know, as readers or listeners even,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have our own associations with those songs. So, you know, I hear Locomotion and I'm back with my cousins in, you know, 1984,
yeah,
you know,
right.
around the living room.
That's
you
right,
know,
exactly.
A little
exactly.
Calm the Line.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's fabulous. I really, mm-hmm. yeah, I think it's a really, I guess, provocative way to sort of historicize, but also personalize
mm-hmm.
the play. Thinking about Wade Compton and Gregory Schofield's work, which is very kind of localized in BC and
mm-hmm.
Western Canada,
right?
And so your work, which is set in Winnipeg, also, you know, has that sort of really local feel. A friend of mine, my housemate, is actually from Winnipeg, and she's like, "Oh, Cathedral! I know exactly where
I
that
know.
Is." And she's telling
yeah,
me, you know,
exactly.
telling me about the neighborhood.
Exactly.
So it's really, really cool to
yeah.
get that kind of local feel from it.
The local feel was more of a regional feel
mm.
that Corinna Vernon, who is one of the the three publishers of
Commodore
Press,
yeah.
she actually wrote, I think it was her dissertation, on Black Prairie writers.
Yeah, yeah.
And so she wanted to do you know, writers that came from not the East, which we're so used to in, you know, everything comes from Toronto or
yeah.
Ontario or Montreal.
Yeah.
And, you know, Wade has done, and other people have done works from, you know, BC writers.
Yeah.
And it was like, there was this void for her of, you know, Black Prairie writers. And I mean, there's, you know, lots of us on the prairies.
Oh, for sure.
Might not see us very much,
but you're there.
Yeah. So, you know, it because of Corinna, it, you know, this came to be too.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's where that's really
yeah.
that's really
and,
interesting.
And the other writer wrote a book. I think her name was Cheryl Boggs. Maybe we could look that up.
Oh yeah.
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
And she wrote Pouring Down Rain.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And she's also from that sort
yeah,
of.
Yeah. She's from the prairies.
Prairies.
Yeah.
Great. Moving from there, that's interesting because we get this kind of trans-Canadian
mm-hmm.
feel. I
yeah,
think,
nice.
Like,
it.
Driving along the Trans
yeah,
Canada,
right? Exactly.
Super. I noticed in my research there was an exhibit called Encre Noir or Black Ink.
Yes.
I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
Yeah.
My French is terrible.
Yeah.
But I noticed that was online, and that featured writing by Black Canadians in Montreal and Quebec. And they also showed it overseas and in Switzerland,
mm-hmm.
it said online.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I was wondering, and I mean, kind of related to that project, what you think about your work kind of in conversation with maybe trans-Canadian or transnational community even, and how that sort of, how your work sort of speaks to their work as opposed to that more local kind of level, because we've talked a little
mm-hmm.
bit about the local. But I wondered if you thought there was any difference between the two, like the sort of global or local, whether there was a divide or whether it's mostly sort of speaking to the same issues.
Okay. I think it's, how would I say it? I think some of the material or the subject or you know, circumstance is unique.
Mm-hmm.
But lots of it is very universal.
Okay.
You know? I think the uniqueness might come in people might learn some of the intricacies
mm-hmm.
of being Black.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the contradictions. What else?
Yeah, I'm thinking especially in terms of community, because you do, like, in the play, you get this sense of this sort of community from your past, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And your readers, maybe you could talk a little bit more
about
that.
And I think it might break down some of the assumptions of, you know, Black families, Black culture,
okay.
the differences between Black Canadians and Black Americans.
Right,
because
right.
most people are familiar with, you know, Black American experience
yes.
because it's in your face.
Yes.
But also there's the universality, there's the commonness of a crazy mother, you know, living in a tough neighborhood, you know, your girlfriend, your first dance.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You're the first time you feel, you know, somebody pressed close to you and a hard
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
You know,
those
the
sort
bully
of embodied
pick, yeah,
things.
Right. Exactly. The bully picking on you.
Yeah.
You know, some of the tragic things that happen in your life that are so common to everyone.
Yeah.
And this is why I think a lot of people really, you know, embrace the book, is because it's so different and yet it's so everyone.
Yeah.
You know? It just brings back the funniest, scariest, wonderful, crazy
yeah,
memories, you
totally.
Know?
Totally.
And, yeah, this is why I love it, too. I mean, I love it. I love the piece,
yeah.
you know? When I performed it, and I've performed it so many times, everywhere, every night was different. Every single performance.
Had a variation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, you're sitting there and you think, oh, my God. Oh, I should have done, I could have turned, and something else will come into you,
yeah.
you know, when you're performing, just, it's just crazy the life it has.
Yeah,
you know?
beyond the text.
Yeah, beyond the text.
Yeah, and you definitely get a feel for that, I think, just listening to you speak right now.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, it excites me. I just really love it. Yeah.
That's great. I want to maybe get into a little bit of the sort of talking about shift gears a little bit. So the title's Stay Black and Die, which I think is brilliant. Penny's mother calls it a Negro proverb.
But I call it a Negro proverb.
You call it a Negro proverb. All right.
She just spouted them.
Okay.
We said, you know, all her sayings, she had the, you know, the craziest sayings
yeah.
of the world. And actually, when we went back to Nova Scotia, like my dad was a porter, so we had a pass on the railroad
yeah,
and we'd go
yeah.
back in the summer. All my aunts and everybody down in Nova Scotia, you know, they talk the same way. And so I thought, oh, my God. But, it, you know, they're just sayings passed down and down and down.
Yeah.
And
everybody kind of knows it.
Everybody kind of knew what they were, except
yeah.
us kids when we were young. We thought, what the hell does that mean?
Yeah.
So we used to call them behind your back Negro proverbs.
Oh, my God.
So Stay Black and Die was one of those. You know,
one of those proverbs.
Yeah, one of those proverbs. Yeah.
So it's such an apt title, and I mean that moment in the play where Penny explains, you know, the circumstances. She says, you know, she was talking to her mom about really wanting something, and she, you know, her mom says, "Girl, don't you tell me about what you have to do, because there's only two things in the world you have to do, and that's to stay black and die."
Yeah.
And it's this moment where I think it's a powerful moment in the play, and it's no surprise that it's the title because it really kind of encapsulates the way that the play actually takes to task that polite brand of Canadian multicultural racism, right?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, so, for example, like, in contrast to, like, the 80s and 90s CBC heritage moments,
you know those
heritage
yeah.
moments, and you get the one dramatizing the pioneering Canadians helping the Black Americans over, you know, the Underground Railroad. I think your book actually gives a more kind of an embodied record of a historical moment, one that emphasizes the impossibility of that kind of polite colorblindness, mm-hmm. which just I think is great. And I'm wondering your thoughts on that and how you sort of thought about kind of the incorporation of that proverb and the way that it sort of works a stereotype to be sort of at once disturbingly familiar but also really comedic and heartrending.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wondered your thoughts on that.
Well, first of all, the title really disturbed people and confused people, some people. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I think I was in Australia performing, and a woman said that her friend wouldn't come to the play because it said "Stay Black and Die," and she thought that was negative. That, you know, meant something like, you know, "Stay Black and you're going to die," or,
oh yeah, okay,
you know, "You should die," or yeah, whatever it yeah. was. And to me, it was it's funny and so profound. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so I wouldn't change it.
No,
you know, I mean, I wouldn't change it. And once you, you know, read the book, see the play, whatever, it just comes to light, like you yeah. say, you just go, oh,
you're like, of course,
yes,
that's the title.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Except it also gives you a hint of what, like you say, that, you know, you're going to delve into something that polite Canadians don't usually delve in, you yeah. know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I come from a 7-generation Canadian family,
mm-hmm.
and yet people don't know what that means. People don't know, you know, what struggles that we have and still have.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to the American struggles, but, you know, of the black
right.
people that were in your face. The book talks about when there was a race riot in Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were coming down to the district where, you know, my mother and everyone lived on the island to kill all of the black people.
Yeah.
And you know, not being able to get a job, not being able to get an apartment. I mean, mm-hmm. just millions of things that, mm-hmm. you know, was life for us. You know, the opportunities that were lost, you know, the possibilities mm-hmm. that could never happen.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody talks about those, you know,
yeah.
like when my brother, who was a brilliant man, he still is, finished school. I mean, not only, and it had nothing to do with, you know, finances.
Yeah.
He could never think of going to university.
No.
I mean, for what? You know what I mean?
Why? Yeah.
He was the first person in our family who didn't have, like, a menial job, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He just went for it, and he got to be an engineer on the railroad, but he started out as a fireman.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, I mean, you know, you could be a porter, or you could shine shoes, or you didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, and that
yeah.
was just the reality of things,
it's
you
true.
Know,
yeah.
in my lifetime.
Yeah.
And
even,
you know,
now.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
and then in the next generation, my nephew Toby, for instance, went to university, you know, got a degree in microbiology, which he doesn't do now. But, you know, because the world had changed that much,
yeah.
you know, in 10, 20 years,
yeah.
like the Canadian world,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
Didn't mean that, you know, getting a job would be any easier, but,
right.
you know, he had the possibility to get one.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Just, you know, Stay Black and Die to me gives a small glimpse of black Canadian experience.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
The fun parts and, you know, a little teeny glimpse of, you know, some of the tragic parts,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And it doesn't even get into them in a way, you know, like my intent is to identify, not to blame, you
yes,
know?
Yes, yeah.
Because there's no point in that.
Yeah, yeah, it can only go so far.
But,
yeah.
but I think people should know. People should be able to look at their neighbor and, oh, for God's sake, George might have, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's just,
yeah.
My intent was just to bring people closer.
Yeah,
you
and
know,
you do
if,
it in
if
so,
they
have
yeah. the, if they have the desire.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think you do it in such a way that, like, I know with the character of the mother who is at once sort of, you know, she understands that you shouldn't call the guy that owns the store down the street a Jew, But then she turns around and talks to her husband and, you know, talks about a black immigrant woman that she sees on the bus. And
talks you're like, about oh the my Jamaicans. God. My yeah. mother was the most amazing woman in the world. You know, she could be teaching you a lesson on something.
Mm-hmm.
And in her explanation, you know, just do exactly what she was telling you not to do. Like,
yeah.
you see, and that's another, you know, example of you know the intricacies and complications and craziness
of
black experience yeah. and Canadian black experience. I don't know about American black experience.
Right.
You could have so many people that you know were racist and prejudiced against you. So mm-hmm. I would think as a kid, well then you wouldn't be racist. But my mother hated Jamaicans and Caribbeans. You know.
Yeah.
For, first of all, she didn't know them and know nothing about them except what she had heard.
Mm-hmm.
And when she was young, you know, people say, oh, those people, you know, they come and live in trees and shit like this, yeah, you know, yeah. so this is in her head. She didn't like them because when they came over, they were different than us,
yeah.
you know. They wore bright colors and they were, you know, very boisterous and, you know, out there and yeah. open, and they weren't quiet. They, you know, people looked at them, and you know that was another thing. When you're black, you don't want people looking at you. You right. know, you just want to go and you know weave your way through people and just leave me alone.
Yeah.
And so that brought people to look at her. You know.
Okay.
And so she was embarrassed, and it's a shame. And you know, the black experience is a whole bunch of shame for a whole bunch of reasons. You
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
And this is what she didn't want. Plus, she didn't know anything about them.
Right.
And it's like anybody else who's, you know, ignorant and prejudiced and racist and, you know.
For sure.
So this what she couldn't stand them. But she knew that you're not supposed to be racist.
Right.
But to her, because they were black, it wasn't like being racist. You know what I mean? Right, it's just like right. craziness.
It was like.
Yeah. She knew that, you know, you shouldn't call a guy a Jew in a demeaning way.
Right.
Because people, oh, that Jew, that definitely doesn't mean they like him because he's Jewish. I mean, yeah. you could say someone is a Jew and, you know, there's difference than
yes,
saying that
yes.
Jew.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, she'd slap you in the face for saying that.
Yeah.
Even if the other kids had said it, and tell you you're not supposed to say wops or frogs or blah, blah, blah. And then tell you, you know, how cheap those Englishmen and Scotsmen were. And, you know, there's nobody cheaper and blah,
yeah,
blah, blah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that Jamaican on the bus, that ugly black thing. So, yeah.
She seemed to understand that there was a hierarchy, even in a society that's mm-hmm. pretending, even in a society that isn't supposed to be racist, there's still those complexities and those hierarchies.
And there's complexities and hierarchies in, you know, the black community.
Yes, yeah.
I wrote a poem called Skintifity, uh-huh. which I say, you know, everything depends on the color of your skin.
Mm.
And when you're black, the lighter skinned you are, you know,
yeah.
the more privilege you get. You know, white people will think you're pretty
huh.
because, you know, you're not quite black. You know, the thinner nose you have, you could, you know, it's just the hair.
Yeah.
I mean,
even within...
I could talk like for hours about
wow.
hair. And so, yeah, so these kind of things also, you know, played such a big part in her life,
yeah.
you know, so it's that people could get a glimpse of that, maybe, you know, just so that they could have a dialogue,
yeah.
you know what I mean,
yeah.
or ask somebody who's black, well, what about this, you know,
yeah.
And what about, you know, hair turning back, what does that mean, and just, you know, and why is that bad, like, you know, I was never allowed to go to camp, my whole life, all my friends went to camp, and my mother would never let me, because I couldn't go swimming, because my hair would turn back.
Huh.
And she
wow.
didn't want anybody to see my hair going nappy because that was a shameful thing, right? Because
oh.
I had to straighten it with a straightening comb
wow.
if I wanted it straight. So all my life, I couldn't go to camp. I mean, just
bizarre,
you know, bizarre
yeah.
things, you know?
Yeah.
Hundreds of them. Hundreds
yeah.
of them.
Which made
know?
Total sense for her in
yeah.
her sort of, you know, how she wanted to sort of see you go
yeah.
about,
yeah.
about your
yeah.
life.
You know, like never eating watermelon, you know?
Huh. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to this day, I look at it and it's all out on plates and buffets and shit, and I go,
like,
I don't know. You
not
know?
So much.
Yeah, right. What a horrible thing.
I'm really looking forward to your new book. And I actually wanted to ask you a little bit about that. We talked a little bit about it the
mm-hmm.
other day. Now it's called Back in the Days. And yeah, I wondered maybe what you thought about, I don't know what our time is like, but I thought it would be really neat if you would maybe as a conclusion kind of tell us a little bit about the new book and if you felt like compelled to possibly read something of it. I know you performed a poem for me the other day. Right. Not to put you on the spot, don't feel like you have to at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, talk a little bit about the book. I mean, we talked a little bit about you had mentioned you were kind of excited about the idea of maybe putting a CD with it.
Yeah.
And yeah, if there are any thoughts that you had, you'd like to share, give us a little preview of what the new book is going to...
Okay, great. It's called Back in the Days, and it's from the voice and head and heart of the same girl, Penny.
Oh, okay.
And stories... Now, see... It's sort of the same style. It's stories of her mother, because some of the stories were, you know, about the bootlegging joints and things like that. Stories from her sister, Mama Cooked the Most Wonderful Dinner for Christmas is one of the stories. But it's my sister's story, who I actually asked permission if I could tell it.
Yeah.
I'm so sad. And... But, you know, I wasn't born. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like she was there for everything. And then some of her stories, you know, and a lot of poetry that is sort of related to growing up back in the day or the mothers back in the day. Because there's poems about the Korean War and the soldiers in the Korean War. Mm-hmm. And the first soldier in my family, you know, my mom's brother, Horeb, in the First World War. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the poems and stories talk about back in the day, but the day goes, you know, way back and forth and back and forth like that.
It's this prolonged time.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah. They're fun. They're fun. I really like them. That's good. I always like my stuff, you know, right?
Yeah.
I like it.
That's good. Yeah. It's a good feeling.
So it will do that. And what started it was... I wanted to do a book of poetry, and it started one way that, okay, I'll just present these poems and you know, will you accept them? And what they said was, well, you know, a lot of the poems have sort of a theme, you know, of the days gone by. Mm. What about if you just did, you know, poems and stories related to the girl, the family back in the days and stuff like that. So then I took a whole bunch of them out and that didn't relate and it started
taking
shape. But the whole thing came from a poem that I actually wrote for, I work for Urban Native Youth Association and I work at a safe house. Mm-hmm. And the kids that come there, we tell them, you know, not to swear while they're there, which is, you know, ridiculous because everybody swears, you know, but you can't have like seven kids in the house swearing and, you know, it just makes too much disturbance and craziness. And so a lot of them also play rap music, you know, and their favorite, little Tupac this and that and it's just like, whoa, okay. And so, and they say they're playing their music and they go, can I play this, you know? And I said, you can't play it if it says, nigga, nigga, bitch, whore, or suck my dick.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So if it does, don't play it. Which, I mean, they don't play anything. Because they all because say every, it.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And like what I was trying to tell them is, you know, things used to be different. And then they go, well, how come I can't say nigga? You know, so-and-so says it, you know, blah, blah, blah. I said, you can't say it. Because you know how many people that, you know, I had to kick their ass for saying that? Do you know how many fights I've had because of that? Mm-hmm. You know how much history is behind that word? I don't care who says it. I don't care if they like it or not. I don't like it. I'll never like it. You can't make me like it. Mm-hmm. You know, and it disturbs me to my soul, you know? Mm-hmm. So then I went home one night and I wrote the poem Back in the Days.
Yeah, and that's where that came from.
Yeah, that's where it came from. If I can remember it. I can tell it to you.
That would be great.
Friday night, man, we'd all get dressed up and we'd be styling, fixing to dance the Madison and jive like there was no tomorrow, back in the days when a bitch was a dog and nigga was a fighting word. And all the Canadian guys would stand around the dance hall and posture and gesture to the American GIs who came to town to take all their girls. Not that they wanted us black girls before the American guys came on the scene, back in the days when a bitch was a dog, nigger was a fighting word. Well, one night, some white guys surrounded Bunny Lane outside. I think they thought they could take on this slight-billed little black guy. Boy, they sure didn't like black guys, because these days, they took all their girls and won every dance contest, no problem. Back in the days when a bitch was a dog, and nigger was a fighting word. Well, Bunny didn't run, and he didn't cower, and he didn't say a word. He just backed up slowly and turned in a circle carefully to survey how many other guys surrounding him were going to fight him. And then he took off his shoes and his socks, and he crouched down in a kung fu tiger pose and gestured with a few short, come on, bring it on motions with his hands. And all those guys scattered like flies. God, I wish you could have been there. We had so much fun back in the days when a bitch was a dog and nigger was a fighting word.